Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this week, we'll be hearing from the director of Twisters, Lee Isaac Chung. We'll also be hearing from the director and star of Long Legs, that's Osgood Perkins and Micah Monroe. Plus, we'll be reviewing those films as well as Space Race, rom-com Fly Me to the Moon, animated sequel Despicable Me 4, new horror Inner Violent Nature, another new horror Sleep. Yeah, so it's a very, very busy week this week. But first, Matthew, have you been watching anything else besides all the stuff that's coming out this week?
I have, yeah. I caught up with Beverly Hills Cop colon Axel F, the fourth belated entry in the Beverly Hills Cop saga.
And how did you find that? We reviewed it last week, and you are probably like the resident Eddie Murphy fan, aren't you, really?
I love Eddie, yeah.
How did you find Axel F?
Very mixed bag. I thought Eddie was terrific as usual. I did LOL a few times, which was kind of like my minimum requirement. I thought if I LOL at least two or three times, I'll be satisfied. But aside from Eddie, I found the rest of it a bit sort of tired and quite formulaic. So I couldn't help feeling a bit disappointed overall. But Eddie did give me some big laughs. His performance in the original was my favourite Eddie Murphy performance.
Oh, wow.
So I was pleased to see him back, but I wasn't sure it was an entirely necessary fourth chapter, to be honest.
I thought I enjoyed it, you know, fine. I thought it was fine, and it was better than Coming to America. And yeah, just enjoyable to have him back in that role. But it feels like a film that will be forgotten like very quickly. Again, I know just the comparison always keeps coming up. And mentioned last week's Top Gun Maverick, just because of it being, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer just bringing back a classic 80s character. And even the styling of the title feels like it's invoking Top Gun Maverick.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But whereas that has had such a big footprint, it just feels like this is just going to be instantly forgotten, really, and that it's not going to be front of anyone's mind when it comes to thinking of films of the year later this year.
Maverick's kind of the benchmark now for legacy sequels, really.
It's just set too high a bar, really, isn't it, for anyone else? Especially ones which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be as good as they were. Yeah, and then I haven't really watched much, to be honest, besides some of the things we're going to be talking about this week. Long-term listeners will know of my Bluey obsession. And they dropped some new Bluey mini-sodes, as they called them, on Disney+. And so, of course, I watched those. And as I would kind of gorge on any sort of Bluey content. And they were enjoyable to me. But obviously, they're just those, like, they're literally like 2 to 3 minute little, almost like little sketches or scenes, not as satisfying obviously as having new season to watch, and they lack like the very best Bluey episodes have real emotional wallop as well, which they didn't really attempt that in any of these mini-sodes. There was one that I thought might have gone in that direction, but then it didn't. So they were fun, but they were very, very throwaway. But you know, I'll still take it. Any new Bluey material, I'm there.
When are we going to get a Bluey feature film? Or is that in the works and it's passed me by?
Not officially, but they've got to be thinking about it, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. Because it's a phenomenon, isn't it?
Just because they're guaranteed a Total Film cover as well if they do a Bluey movie, aren't they, really?
We're waiting for you.
But anyway, on to this week's new releases now. First up, it's time to go for another spin with this one.
I'm sorry for what happened. You know a tornado rating? It's not based on size and wind speed.
I've got it, UK!
It's based on damage. What it destroys, what it takes from us.
So that is Twisters, which is the new sort of sequel to the 1996 classic Twister. And once again, obviously, we're in the world of storm chasing and tracking and trying to sort of mitigate the effects of tornadoes, basically. But before me and Matthew discuss this film in a bit more detail, first we're going to hear from director Lee Isaac Chung, who I spoke to in London yesterday.
If we pull this off, it could help save thousands of lives. You don't face your fears. You
could ride him.
The heat's intensifying it.
You ever see anything like this?
Never.
I saw the film last night at the European premiere in London. There was a sort of surprise guest in the audience, Mr. Tom Cruise. Like, were you aware he was going to be there?
I didn't know he was going to be there. And he was very kind. He said hello before the film, and I was able to say hi to him. And I could just see how much affection he has for Glenn in that moment when we were all backstage, if you will. It seems like there's a real genuine deep friendship there. So that was really beautiful to see.
And how did it feel for you watching the film knowing that Tom's watching it as well?
Okay, so Tom, in front of me was Daisy and Daisy's parents. And then in front of Daisy was Tom and Glenn. I kept on watching Tom, I gotta admit, as I'm watching the film. And I was just curious, you know, how he's reacting to the movie. And I would see that he keeps on leaning forward and touching somebody. And I was like, who's that? And then I realized he's actually patting Anthony Ramos on the back during various scenes. And I was really touched by that. He was being so supportive and loving to other fellow actors and really acknowledging the work they're doing. So it was really cool. I gained a lot of newfound respect for him.
And for anyone who is familiar with Twister and remembers seeing that, but hasn't seen Twisters yet, how would you describe the connection between these two films? How do you see it? Do you see it as a sequel or a reboot? How would you describe it?
I studied science in university, so this is probably a nerdy answer. I see it as a new science experiment. So it's maybe a same world. We don't have the same characters, but it's a new experiment. And there are a lot of nods to the original, but I hope I've made it its own thing as well. Like, that's what I found invigorating about making this movie, was a chance to do something new with that first story that I really loved, to do a new chapter, if you will.
And was there ever any stage where you considered sort of incorporating some of the old characters more, or did you always just want it to be a kind of a fresh start with new characters for this one?
That decision was kind of made before I got on board. The studios, everybody involved, really wanted to run with this script that Joe Kosinski and Mark L. Smith being the primary writer, that they had developed. I think they liked this idea of a direction where it's a whole new story. So I kind of came into it during that process, and I've kind of generally hoped to share it with the past cast if they're interested, and also Jan de Bont, who I haven't been able to chat with. Yeah, I hope that we've honored the work that they've done.
And obviously you mentioned Tom Cruise earlier, but in terms of other film titans, Steven Spielberg's an executive producer on this and Amblin's a production company. Did you kind of have any direct or indirect advice from Steven Spielberg at any point making this?
He's been wonderfully supportive and giving through this whole process. I had to pitch to him, and then when I was revising and working on the script with Mark, you know, I had to share iterations with him. And then also even into post-production, when I was editing, he would come in and watch cuts with me. And never as an imposing figure. He was always very generous and giving and enthusiastic. He loves tornadoes. He loves watching tornado videos online. Like, he has a genuine fandom of this stuff. So he brought his enthusiasm into this, and I just really feel like he empowered me in a wonderful way.
And could you say a bit about your personal experiences that sort of fed into this film and your understanding of this whole world?
Just on the level of growing up in that region of the U.S., I leaned heavily into that. Kate grew up on a farm. I grew up on a farm. It's a story of Kate trying to re-find her identity in place, in work, and in family, and that's something that I very much relate to. I tried to bring all of that into the story. And then in general, I love the natural world, and I grew up around tornadoes. That was the major possible devastating event that could happen where I was growing up in Northwest Arkansas. So all of that just figures in. So it's hard to say what specifically it is, but it was a project where I felt like I could bring a lot of myself into.
And obviously on paper, Twisters is just such a different film to Minari, your previous feature. Mm-hmm. But did you see kind of connections, or were there kind of lessons you learned on Minari that felt like they informed how you would tackle something like Twisters?
Yeah, there's an early scene in Minari where, on the TV there's a tornado warning, and everybody is scared in the family, and everyone's mad at Dad for bringing them to the farm. That's kind of based on real life. Like that's an episode that actually happened in my life. I used a clip of that in my pitch for getting onto this movie to show that, hey, I've been interested in tornadoes for quite a long time. But probably the single scene that was most important for me in making that movie was there's a massive fire that takes down that barn, and we built that barn to burn it. And we did that practically. And we had only one take to do it, and we were filming on the fly, and this massive fire was bigger than anything I could have imagined and envisioned for that scene. It just took my breath away as I was doing it. And then I remember gaining my senses again, and I felt like Steven Yeun and Yeti Han, they were a little too close to the fire, and they were acting and performing, and I scooted them back physically to, like, let's get further away from this fire. And throughout the editing process of that scene, I would go back and watch that often, and I just felt like I would love to explore doing a movie where it's that power of nature or some kind of phenomenon that draws us out of ourselves. I'd love to do that for an entire movie. And when I got the script for Twisters, I felt like this was an opportunity to do that. Like, tornadoes were my new fire. Like, I could play with that incredible, awesome power and treat it with awe and reverence and see how that transforms people's lives.
Twister had this kind of almost like lightning in a bottle cast. Were you looking to replicate anything about that sort of dynamic or that group that Jan de Bont had for Twisters?
Yeah, what I was hoping to replicate was that film made me feel a sense of camaraderie and friendship with a group of people I don't know. And all those people were an eclectic bunch of chasers. Incredible actors such as Alan Ruck, and you have Todd Field, and of course Philip Seymour Hoffman, this group of friends who are chasing together. It's just an incredible group of people. I wanted to create a group of chasers with this one who I want to spend time with and who I want to chase with. That sense of friendship, I feel, is a great part of that first one, that we had an opportunity to do that with this one.
And Twisters has a really great kind of supporting cast as well, with just lots of great faces in there that people will probably recognize from at least something they've seen and enjoyed, be it kind of Daryl McCormack, Sasha Lane, mm-hmm. and people like that. Also, you've got David Corenswet in a kind of key supporting role, and he's Superman coming up. What do you think makes him right for Superman?
So David was going out for that role when we were filming, and I remember we were all really secretly rooting for him. And when we found out he was on the short list, a lot of us were saying, you know, he actually would be a great Superman. He is such a imposing and big presence, larger than life, but he's there's this genuine purity to him in a weird way that I feel fits a lot with Superman. I remember when he came back from doing auditions in LA, he came back to set, and he was still carrying that Superman to us. Like, he's someone who stays within the role a little bit. I'm not saying he's method, but he kind of takes on that aura a little bit. For us, he was playing an antagonist, so a lot of times I was just seeing Scott. But when he came back from that audition, I remember feeling like he must have got it. Like, it was this weird sense that I had that he just looked the part, he just felt the part to me. So, I feel James Gunn is lucked out finding this guy, because he's a real discovery, and he's gonna kill it.
And it feels significant in this film that, like, a cinema plays a key role in one of the big set pieces. Was that something important? Were you kind of thinking about this as a cinema experience when that became part of the film?
Yeah, absolutely. On a meta level, like, I've just been generally feeling like we need more big screen type of moments and experiences as people, that we need to let our eyes be taken to something bigger than ourselves. And that limitation shouldn't even be a movie screen. It could, that's what I love about the screen ripping out and revealing something bigger. We constantly need to be, our attention be turned to something bigger than ourselves. And I love that sequence that we were able to do that. One of the most challenging things to film on this movie, but we all had a deep conviction about what it meant.
And you've previously directed an episode of The Mandalorian, and you've got an episode of Skeleton Crew coming up. How is that going to compare to The Mandalorian, do you think, as far as Star Wars shows go?
I can't wait for people to see this thing. It's got a lot of John Watts in it, and anyone who's a fan of what John Watts does, he's very childlike in a beautiful way, in the way that he tells stories and how he captures a childlike perspective in things. And he brings that beautiful perspective to this story of young people in the Star Wars universe, which I felt like I hadn't seen this when I read all of the scripts. And when I was looking at the design of what he was designing, he asked if I would be on board, and it was a no-brainer for me once I saw what he was working on. Then also working with him on that show, and with Jude and all the incredible actors who we have, it was a lot of fun. We were just having fun all the time. The kids were incredible and great. What I hope is that it's really going to touch families, and families will want to spend a lot of time with this show.
So that was Lee Isaac Chung on Twisters. To talk in a bit more depth about this film and set up a bit more, Matthew, here in this film, we're, as we sort of discussed there, we're completely separate in terms of characters, aren't we, from the first Twister movie remember.
Completely, yeah.
And very early on, we see Dorothy is still in the picture, which was this bit of kit that was, which was designed and created to measure tornadoes and like the speeds and learn more about them, basically. So that still exists in the film. So we are still in the same world, but obviously we're in just completely different characters, different territory. And the main character, in a sense, is Kate, played by Daisy Edgar Jones. And very early on in the film, we see her out in the field with various colleagues and friends, her partner, and trying to do her own experiments, basically. And then things go very wrong, which leads to her, you know, walking away for 5 years from this field that she clearly loves and she clearly has a very intuitive understanding of. But she leaves that behind for a kind of desk job in New York until one of these colleagues, Harvey, played by Anthony Ramos, comes back into the picture. And he's basically got hold of some new tech that he thinks could really enlighten them on the world of Twisters. So he basically begs her to come out for a week to Oklahoma and, you know, work with him there. And she's talked into it, obviously, because otherwise we wouldn't have a film. And then there, similar to how the first film had these two rival factions of storm chasers going on, here Anthony Ramos's kind of tech team end up crossing paths with this, they're kind of like a social media influencers of the tornado world.
Yeah.
And they're YouTube stars led by Tyler Owens, played by Glenn Powell. So they cross paths. And then as in the first Twister, there's not like a great deal of like sort of what you might call storyline from there on,
no.
But they just put in the path of these, you know, like once in a generation systems converging, you know, at the same time. And we sort of follow them from storm to storm, basically, after that. In many ways, it is similar to the original in that sense. But Matthew, did you enjoy this film?
It took me a while to warm to it. I found the first half quite sort of twisted by numbers, like you mentioned, starting with that kind of opening trauma, which I remember happened in the original film, then cutting to the present and developing this kind of fractious relationship between a man and a woman to Twister chasers. But I think, as it went on, I kind of got a bit more involved in it. I think the point where I started to enjoy it more is when they kind of let the chemistry between Daisy Edgar Jones and Glenn Powell breathe a bit more. There's a whole section where it is just them and they're kind of working through their issues and kind of starting to learn more about each other. And I felt that's when I started to kind of relate to it a bit more. But I did find it overall a bit sort of blockbusting by numbers. I felt it was quite short on surprise, not just in terms of the story, but I didn't find any of the set pieces like really kind of transporting. I mean, back when the original came out, digital effects were still in their relative infancy, so it was quite innovative and quite a new thing to see these giant tornadoes being brought to the screen kind of realistically. Whereas now, I mean, obviously we've kind of advanced in effects, but I still felt it didn't really bring the kind of spectacle I was sort of hoping for. I wasn't kind of swept away, pun intended. But yeah, I mean, I thought it's kind of interesting that this time last year we had Anthony Ramos in another blockbuster kind of relaunch with the Transformers movie, and I felt this had the kind of a similar sort of effect, really. Sort of kind of playing the sort of the greatest hits and kind of and sticking to the formula, but not offering anything greatly surprising or new.
That is harsh for me to compare it to Transformers: Rise of the Beast, I must
Yeah.
say.
Well, you're
Is
not a
it?
fan of that film.
No, not at all.
No.
But I have slightly mixed feelings on Twisters, and
Yeah.
I've been sort of, kind of invested in it in the sense that I did the interviews for our cover feature as well a while back, and Twister was one of the sort of pivotal films for me really growing up. I remember it being one of the early films I went to see at the cinema, like without
Yeah.
parents. And as you mentioned, it was obviously very groundbreaking in terms of the effects and stuff at that time. So that I remember having like it feeling really immersive and quite scary when I saw it, relatively young. So I was kind of, yeah, I was interested in this. I really liked the cast as well. So I liked the idea of Lee Isaac Chung doing it as well. And there's just something very, very intriguing about going from Minari to
Yeah.
something as huge as this.
Yes.
And it was one of those films that, like, it didn't 100% work for me on every level. And several of your qualms, I do agree with. I didn't always think the effects were quite where they needed to be. And having rewatched the original film ahead of doing the feature, like the effects there do seem a bit ropey now compared to how, as a,
Right, yeah.
as a kid, I saw it and it just
Yeah.
felt like it was just completely real. It sort of felt like it was lacking a certain spark sometimes for me to really kind of take it up into that, very top level of blockbusters.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I did enjoy it throughout, and I felt like it got a lot right as well. In that I did like that compared to a lot of blockbusters, it was a bit more character based. They sometimes pay lip service to the fact they're going to do that, but I felt there was a bit of that here. I felt like it was trying to do the right thing a lot. Like it felt like its heart was in the right place, and so I feel compared to a lot of blockbusters that just feel like really cynical and like cynical sort of cash-ins. I didn't get that vibe from this. Yeah, I felt very warm towards it, even though I didn't
Yeah.
always think it 100% delivered. And I sort of obviously briefly mentioned this in the interview, but I liked the supporting cast, and there's lots of like cool faces that you'll see and
Yeah.
you'll vaguely recognize from something, probably, be it like Sacha Lane or Darryl McCormack, Katie
Yeah,
O'Brien,
Katie
obviously
O'Brien,
recently
yeah.
seen in Love Lies Bleeding. Obviously, as discussed, David Corenswet, like the new Superman, he's got a
Yeah.
brief but kind of important supporting role in there.
Yeah, I liked him a lot. I felt like he was to this film what Glenn Powell was to Top Gun Maverick. It's kind of bringing this sort of edge and energy to the film, kind of stealing a few scenes. So it made me hopeful for Superman, more hopeful.
And so like so there was lots I liked about it, and yeah, even if it didn't 100% deliver, and I also felt that it built to its best set piece for me,
Yeah.
which is what you want from this kind of film. You want it to kind of escalate, and you want to leave feeling you've had the big climax, basically the climactic set piece that really delivers. So I enjoyed that. Yeah, and it feels to me like a film that even with reservations, I feel like if you pay your money to go and see this at the cinema, I would come away being satisfied with that. I think I wouldn't come away thinking, oh, what have I seen? What why did I bother with that? As I might have felt after Rise of the Beasts, for example. Whereas with this, yeah, I feel like you got money's worth. Although I wouldn't necessarily come out like you are with certain, very top tier blockbusters where you come out feeling like you have to see this, like tell everyone, you've got to see this. Whereas
Yeah.
this is like, yeah, if you're in the mood for a blockbuster, it's an enjoyable, kind of thoughtful film that's, treats it everything, you know, with a decent amount of respect, and is nicely done, heart in the right place, strong cast, then I think it delivers, but it doesn't over deliver. That's my ultimate take, I suppose, on that.
We did see it in quite special circumstances, didn't we? I mean,
yes.
Not only we saw it on an IMAX screen, and it was the premiere, but there was a very special guest in attendance, and, wasn't it?
Yes, as mentioned in that interview, obviously Tom Cruise was there, which created like a crazy amount of excitement, obviously, before the film started. And I suppose in the back of my mind, maybe if I watched it again without Cruise in the crowd, like it just creates a weird buzz in the room, I suppose.
Yeah, it did.
Maybe I wasn't just as immersed as I perhaps could have been under normal circumstances. And I'll tell you one thing I am going to do is I'm going to really try my hardest to find this in 4DX as well to see, because I feel like it's the kind of roller coaster ride, one set piece to the next, that will benefit from that.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I think that'll be fun. So I'm going to try and do that.
Yeah, you need to feel that wind on your face.
Yes. But if you do fancy seeing that Twisted is actually out next week. It's out in cinemas in the UK from Wednesday, the 17th of July. But next up, it's one of the most buzzed about horror films of the year.
Is it scary being a lady FBI agent?
Yeah.
Take a nice long look. A letter was left with the bodies. Signed with one word.
So that was Long Legs, which is a new horror film set in the 90s. And we're following an FBI agent played by Micah Monroe as she's assigned to this case involving a satanic serial killer played by Nicolas Cage. But before me and Matthew talk about this film, we're now going to hear from the film's director, Osgood Perkins, and the film's star, Micah Monroe, from when they spoke to Amy West last week.
And on his horns, he wore 10 crowns. And on each head was written a blasphemous name.
What aren't you telling me?
He'll kill and kill again.
I know you're not afraid of a little bit of dark.
So the film is obviously fictional, but clearly kind of inspired by some true events that happened in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Oz, did you have a particular case that you looked into, or were you more sort of influenced by, you know, FBI detective movies?
I can't look at real things. I don't like them. They don't sit well with me. I don't want to know about real stuff. All this stuff couldn't be more fictionalized and totally made up. It's part of the fun of it to me. It's like, oh, that's how FBI people probably talk. Oh, that's how they probably come into rooms. I don't know. Maybe it's something like this. It's part of what keeps it light for me, honestly. Like if I was to start getting into like, I'm not interested in what these sickos do. Like to me, this is a different kind of poem, you know, and it's totally just make-believe.
Micah, how do you sort of go about playing a character like Lee where, you know, the majority of your scenes are kind of silently poring over clues? How do you sort of make sure that you're not going like, and kind of like over-egging it sort of thing?
A lot of scenes you don't need to be talking, and a lot is said just with, you know, physicality and things that are happening in the eyes.
Hand an actor a good prop and I'll show you a happy actor.
Yeah, give me something good to work with. And
I remember one time I asked an actor, like, you spend the majority of the film like painting, and he was like, I mean, it was great, like I didn't have to learn as many lines, like that's
ideal, really.
And a lot of the thing the film is you reacting as well. What was the most genuine reaction that you had on set where you kind of were like, okay, I'm not actually acting here?
Oh, when I saw Nick as Long Legs for the first time, that was incredibly genuine, because I didn't see him before Oz called action and I walked into the room. So that was all very real.
Did you have an like inclination as to what he was going to look like, or was it all a surprise?
Maybe an inclination just based on, you know, some of my initial conversations with Oz and through the script. But it's, you know, it's one thing to read and hear about something versus seeing it sitting 2 feet away from you.
I wanted to talk to you, Oz, about the prosthetics and the wig and stuff like that. How important was that with the characterization? Why did you think the prosthetics were such an important part of this character?
Well, in the script, he's referred to as someone who's been sort of ruined by living the life that he's had to live. And for me, a shortcut to that is when you see someone who's had plastic surgery, you're like, wow, you really that up, didn't you? Like your whole thing, everything that was you is now ruined. So that was kind of elemental. That's like a shorthand of how to do that. And then you just start to get into it with makeup people, and he's talking about like what is kind of busted plastic surgery look like. You know, early on in the development of how the part was going to come off, Nick was really enthusiastic about burying himself and not being recognizable, which I thought was awesome because I don't think he's ever done that before. And then you just start building it kind of piece by piece, and you edit, and you like anything else, you shape it and you sculpt it and you throw things away and you try again.
It kind of feels like a big question to ask, but I guess it's one to both of you. What was it like working with Nicolas Cage?
He's everything that you want him to be. I'm so happy to report. It's like you come down on Christmas morning and there's a Nicolas Cage shaped package under your Christmas tree, and you open it up and he just starts going like it's Nicolas Cage because it's Nicolas Cage. And he's intensely prepared. He has read everything. He's seen every movie that you could ever want to reference. He knows everybody's name. He knows every performance. He can quote every song. He likes all the same things you do. He's in complete control of his instrument. He's just on it. It's a privilege. What can I say? It's like having a racehorse all of a sudden on your movie. And it's like, well, I guess that thing is just going to do its thing. And I'll stand by and make sure that nothing kind of goes too far that way or not enough this way. I mean, I can't imagine directing Nicolas Cage with like a strong hand. It's like a very gentle touch. It's like just like positioning a little thing here every once in a while. This is like a cello or a harp or a saxophone.
I was going to ask as well, there are a couple of moments where he kind of like bursts into a song. Was that in the script or did that come from Nicolas?
The words are in the script. If it's a song, then I can get credited for the lyric, but the performance is his. The phrasing and the kind of the decibels and all that are all his. And I love when those kind of little Nick Cage-esque moments kind of peek out. It's really gratifying, having been such a huge fan of his for so long.
And I was quite struck by how much the violence is kind of obscured. I think when I saw the tweets from people about saying it's brutal and stuff like that, I mean, I watch a lot of horror, so I was expecting something super in your face. But a lot of it kind of happens away from the screen or after the fact, you're looking at injury detail. Why was it important for you to do that and not kind of dwell on the gore of it so much?
Because the world is ugly enough as it is, you know, and like brutality against people is not that cool. So you put it off screen because it's an imperative in what is going on in the story. You know what I mean? But you try to couch it a little bit in at least something that looks okay, because I'm not trying to upset anybody. I know that people have strong reactions to this movie, but honestly, I just tried to make something that I thought was kind of pretty.
And I feel like a lot of films like this, they kind of leave things open-ended, but I feel like this kind of tied things quite neatly. Like there's whether people are like, what the hell or not, but it's like you explain what has happened. Why did you sort of want to have that like definitive, okay, this is what's going on moment?
Just because I felt like it was Lee's story to be told. Like Lee's path from when she was 9 to the end of the movie is like a movement, right? And it ends with the worst thing that she could possibly do, which I won't say. You know, her last action that she takes in the movie, the last shot that she fires, is that's the worst thing that a person can probably do. So it gets to a point where, for me, it's just like the devil or whoever is behind it all. It's like Daniel Day-Lewis at the end of There Will Be Blood, right? I'm finished. Right, it's like that kind of a thing. I think that kind of thing is great.
You're kind of gearing up to do They Follow. How do you think you're going to approach that? You know, having had 10 years between doing the first one and having done so much since, how are you going to go into it approaching it?
I really don't know. I mean, I absolutely loved working with David, and I love Jay. And I think where you find her in this sequel is very unexpected and super interesting. And I think, you know, it's going to be such a joy to work with David and jump back into this role again.
So that was Osgood Perkins and Micah Monroe on Long Legs. Matthew, do you want to just set this one up a bit further for us, for anyone who hasn't seen it? Because I haven't seen this yet, and I don't know a great deal about it beyond that very vague synopsis I gave beforehand. I know it's kind of in the serial killer world. I've heard Silence of the Lambs comparisons, but yeah, I don't know much about it. So without spoiling, yeah, set it up for us a bit more.
Probably shouldn't go into too much detail, but yeah, Silence of the Lambs is a very a strong comparison. I mean, well, it's set in the 90s for one thing, and Micah Monroe's character seems very much styled on Jodie Foster. I mean, she seems to be wearing one of her outfits in one scene and having the same haircut. But she's quite a different character. But yeah, it's essentially, it's not a kind of a whodunit. It's very much a, this killer is out there. We know who this killer is. And it's trying to decipher all these clues that he's left behind. He's left this trail of clues. He's kind of his own code, which has to be cracked. And so Micah Monroe is on this case, and she's an incredibly intuitive detective. There's a scene early on where she just knows that something disastrous is about to happen. She kind of gets on the trail. But then there are links to the past. There's we start off with a prologue that's set in the 70s involving the character, the long legs, Nicolas Cage character, and a young girl. And then we see how this kind of pays off in the present later on. We're kind of joining the dots. So it's very much a kind of a police procedural, but there's also this kind of it's underpinned by these kind of occult goings on as well. So the character is basically a Satanist. And so that plays into it. There's possibly supernatural things going on. There's some stuff involving creepy dolls, which is such a horror staple. There's a good deal of that, and yeah, we're waiting for all these things to come together for a confrontation between cat and mouse. So that kind of plays out, and yeah, similar to Silence of the Lambs, it's very much sort of focused on the FBI and how they proceed. There's a big role for Michael Monroe's boss, who's played by Blair Underwood, who I was very pleased to see, having been a fan of L.A. Law back in the day. So it was really nice to see him in a nice big role, and he and his family play a part in this as well. And also Michael Monroe's mother, played by Alicia Witt, she has a fairly substantial role. I probably have said too much already, but probably shouldn't go too much into it. It's very much a procedural.
And yeah, it feels like a film to enjoy cold. But did you enjoy it? Like, enjoy is the wrong word. But yeah, were you satisfied by this film?
I think perhaps coming into it, because it's been so tight. I mean, including, I'd say, by Total Film, we've given it 5 stars. Well, I've seen another horror film that's out this week on this podcast, and I found Long Legs to be the lesser of the two horror films. But I mean, having said that, it's incredibly stylish. I mean, it really is like one of those films where every angle, the way everything's lit, the art direction, every single shot seems so kind of precise and kind of imbued with meaning. It's quite jumpy. There's lots of like flash cuts, sudden appearances of horrible things. So you are very much on edge throughout. I think one of the issues I had with it, I mean, he's not in it a great deal, Nicolas Cage, but I just didn't find him scary. I mean, this is one of his deep dives into the dressing up box. I mean, it's not really, because you see him quite early on, it's not really a spoiler, but he has like prosthetics and a wig. I did find him a bit sort of pantomime, I mean, in comparison to something like someone like Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. He didn't quite sort of get under my skin. So it kind of felt to me sort of more like a kind of a fairground ride type of horror. And I've also seen comparisons with Zodiac, with David Fincher's Zodiac, and I really didn't think it was on that kind of level of that really kind of getting to grips with a procedure and the kind of the agonies and frustrations of chasing someone who's always out of reach and the creepiness. But yeah, it has some very, very effective moments. I mean, dolls are just, they are such a staple of horror, and I think you just can't go wrong with a creepy doll. So it's always good to have that, and performances are very strong, but yeah, it didn't quite kind of linger with me.
I'm surprised it's only a 15, actually, given the hype around it. Just some people say it's the scariest film of the decade, I think, is splashed on the poster and trailer.
It's not particularly violent. There are disturbing scenes, but yeah, it's not especially. It is more about the kind of suspense and the atmosphere than anything kind of particularly hideous. But yeah, there is some bloodshed. So if you are kind of if you're keen on that, if you didn't get your fix from Maxine, then there's some carnage to go around here as well.
So obviously Osgood Perkins is the son of Anthony Perkins, who obviously people will know from Psycho most famously. And he's done some acting himself, and he has directed a few things before, but nothing that I'd really seen or even heard of.
No, me neither.
Would you say he's got like a promising future as a director? He's obviously doing a new film produced by James Wan called The Monkey. That's, I'm sure that's supposed to be like a a family, a more family friendly horror, I suppose. But is he someone whose work you would kind of keep an eye on, do you think, after this?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, he's obviously yeah, a really strong stylist and someone who's very much in control of his vision. I mean, the film is so sort of consistent in what it's going for, the effects it's going for. It doesn't sort of feel compromised. So yeah, he feels like it could be like the next big kind of horror auteur, I think. It did remind me of like Ari Aster's work at times throughout
Okay.
this, things like Midsommar and Hereditary. I did find those films more effective than this one. But yeah, that kind of going for that sort of unease and capturing it in, very sort of deliberate color choices and lighting and camera angles.
Interesting. Yeah, it's one of those films. I mean,
Yeah.
I'm very interested by taking it because obviously, as you mentioned, Neil Smith gave it 5 stars for us, and there
He
have been a
did,
lot of
yeah.
positive reviews. I have seen a few other sort of mixed reactions just online as well. So I definitely will check it out. I'm very intrigued to check it out. But yes, if you did like the sound of that and want to check that out, that is Long Legs, which is in cinemas from Friday the 12th of July. And next up, we're heading to the moon.
The whole world will be watching. We can't afford to lose to the Russians. We need to shoot a backup version of the moon landing.
You mean to fake it? No one can ever know what we're doing.
I cannot accept that.
They will shoot you.
What is my budget?
Oh, boy.
I know a lot more about the moon than I know about you.
So this is Fly Me to the Moon, which is it's quite a hard one to categorize
It is, yeah.
genre-wise, because broadly speaking, I'd call it a big romantic comedy, but it's also set very much in the 60s space race, set within NASA as they're, obviously trying to get to the moon in this race with the Soviet Union. The characters this is hung off is Channing Tatum is Cole Davis, who works at NASA and he's in charge of the launch. And Scarlett Johansson is Kelly Jones, and she's this marketing hotshot who's brought in to basically make NASA cool and sexy to the public and get them invested, make astronauts cool and marketable, and get people excited about the space race and get behind it, because they're obviously plowing a lot of money into it when there's other things that need money and they're trying to keep morale up. Yeah, just trying to get the country behind this effort. So a large part of the film really is this spark between those two. They have a bit of a meet cute before they realize they're going to be working together. And it's the classic, frosty sort of relationship that will they or won't they learn to love each other. So that's a large part of it. And then there is a lot of fun with Kelly, the things she brings to the NASA, and the way she kind of sells it. And she's just one of those people. She's a bit like a more upbeat Don Draper in a lot of ways, and she's got
Yeah.
solutions to every problem, ways
Basically,
around
Don crossed with Joan, isn't she?
it. And
Imagine.
she's willing to like, if she will bring in actors if she feels like the actual NASA staff themselves aren't kind of delivering what they need to for the TV interviews and things like that. And she's just very resourceful, in ways of making things work out to her benefit. And so you get a lot of sparky, banter between those two. But then also in the mix is this faking the moon landing element, because someone who's very much enjoying themselves in the film is Woody Harrelson, who's playing a character called Mo. And again, he's broadly speaking like a government type from the office of the president. He kind of is the architect behind it all. And fairly late on, even though people are aware this is a part of the film, so it's not really a spoiler to say this, but he instructs Kelly to basically assemble a fake backup moon landing film that they could use in case things actually don't go to plan with the Apollo 11 mission, because he just doesn't want any hitch, doesn't want anything to, show up the US. So then this kind of element comes into it, this sort of conspiracy element, this faking a movie element. As you can kind of tell from me saying this, there is quite a lot going on here, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, very
In
much.
some ways, it could have even done without that whole element, I thought. But overall, I don't know if you agree with me, Matthew, but I did enjoy this film, and
Yeah, I did.
it's very much a throwback to the star-powered rom-coms of
Oh,
yesteryear.
yeah.
So in that sense, I almost just appreciated it because we just don't get so many of them, obviously, at the moment, and it felt a bit different. And I thought Scarlett in particular was just very, very enjoyable performance. and really, really like fitted that character well. And there's just something fun and satisfying and sort of delightful about just seeing her, the way she just makes every situation work for her, really, right from the beginning. So that I liked. And then I liked, like Channing Tatum, to be fair, he's not my favorite of the A-list leads out there, but I thought he was decent. Perhaps the film lacks a bit of chemistry between those two, I would say, but not to, for me anyway, not to a ruinous degree. It wasn't like that you're thinking, oh, how on earth have these two been put together? This is a disaster. It was more like they just didn't have that like crazy spark that, say, like that Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt had recently in The Fall Guy, or that, you know, Ryan Gosling has with Emma Stone, or seemingly anyone. But I thought they had enough to sort of, you know, make it work for the film. Like Woody Harrelson was fun. And there were some fun elements to do with this, you know, faking the film. And Jim Rash from Community, he kind of comes in as the director of that fake film, and he's very fun. Yeah, he's so there was lots to enjoy, but then perhaps it went on a bit long. The third act kind of dragged out a bit when you've ultimately got a pretty predictable story on both kind of parts of the narrative, and so it felt like it perhaps dragged on a bit there when you ultimately know where it's going. But that said, I actually enjoyed it. Like, it's an easygoing sort of crowd pleaser. It's hard not to enjoy this. It's just nicely put together. What did you think, Matthew?
Yeah, similar. I did find it a bit overlong. I felt in the midsection it did get a bit baggy, really. It wasn't until it kind of finds its focus a bit more with the fake landing and setting that up and carrying that off and trying to get past this big obstacle that is Woody Harrelson. But yeah, I thought, Johansson and Channing Tatum, they just have a look. They really sort of fit that period. Mm. They kind of, like, they could have come from, I mean, they're such sort of glamorous, kind of sculpted movie stars. They look like they could come straight from that era. So they were quite a real joy to watch. Yeah, especially her. I mean, she seems to really kind of relish this character. You know, she's being so sort of quick-witted and, you know, always keeping everybody else on their toes, being one step ahead of everybody, doing slightly underhand things, but doing it in a very sort of charming way. So you're always on her side. It gets away with it. She gets away with it. Whereas Channing is kind of, he's a bit more sort of noble and sincere and brooding because he's got this past trauma that he's kind of reckoning with. So I did enjoy it a lot. I mean, at first I was a bit kind of befuddled by the sort of mix of fact and fiction. I can't think of many other films that are like this that are very much rooted in a real sort of big historical event, but kind of then bolt on these fictional characters and this situation that's quite contrived. It's very different from something like Hidden Figures, which, you know, feels much more sort of biographical, even though it's dealing with the same events. But then ultimately, I just kind of went with it and just enjoyed it for what it is, you know, just a big old-fashioned rom-com. Like you said, the sort we don't really see that often, or we don't see on movie screens anymore. So it's very pleasant to see that kind of throwback now.
It has surprisingly good production values, isn't it, as well? That, like, it does feel like a big
Apple
scale,
behind it, hasn't it? They've got a bit of a chunk of change that they can put behind movies such as this.
And so you really feel the production designs, and that was another thing which just made it feel a bit different and refreshing to me, I suppose, because it was a rom-com. But then you got big stars plus just this big setting that just felt convincing.
Yeah.
So it felt like a large scale. It's directed by Greg Berlanti, who has directed some films before, including Love, Simon most recently, but he's perhaps best known for his TV stuff, particularly in the Arrowverse. I thought it was all handled very very solidly, looked great in terms of those production values. So it felt like, to me, it was like a crowd pleaser. It felt to me like if you had a film that you needed to watch with a lot of different people, this would fit the bill, and it's just goes down nicely, is easy to watch, and you also get this added interest from the, you know, the historical context and the NASA setting. It just was easy to watch, worked well, that I thought. All that said, still not ever fully like blowing me away for those couple of reservations I had, but I did find it very entertaining.
It's kind of a film I've sort of felt when I was watching it, it felt like a 4-star movie, but then afterwards felt more like a 3-star movie in that weird way. Sort of very enjoyable in the moment, but one I wouldn't sort of rush to revisit.
Yeah, I probably felt similar to that, really, to be honest.
Certainly a good night out at the cinema.
Yeah. And when I saw it a little while ago, and I hadn't seen a trailer even at the time I saw it, so it just took me pleasantly by surprise. So maybe again, if that tricky thing with any review, that if you like with Long Legs, almost perhaps that you had with the hype building up too much. But if you build it up too much, then any film can sometimes just struggle to live up to its hype.
Yeah.
But an enjoyable throwback rom-com for me. And so if you like the sound of that, that is Fly Me to the Moon, which is in cinemas from Friday the 12th of July. And next up, it's the latest installment for Gru and the Minions.
Gru, I need a word with you. Your family's lives are at stake.
What?
Maxime Lamau has escaped from prison.
I'm coming for my revenge, Gru!
We have to get to the safe house.
It has a vending machine! I love this place!
Oh, la la! Luca!
That is Despicable Me 4. Matthew, I haven't seen this one yet, so could you tell us where we find ourselves in Despicable Me 4, which is obviously it's the fourth in the Despicable Me series technically, but
yeah,
we've also had two Minions prequels as well. So what's going on in Despicable Me 4?
Yeah, so yeah, we catch up with the reformed supervillain Gru. He's living the family life. He's got a new baby with his partner, but then a figure from his past, Maxime Lamau, who's voiced by Will Ferrell, an older school rival, he escapes from jail and comes gunning for Gru. So Gru has to go into witness protection. So then we get a subplot where this becomes a sort of fish out of water comedy because Gru and his family relocate to the suburbs where they struggle to fit in. They've got quite some snooty neighbours who they clash with. And all the while, Maxime is trying to get his revenge on Gru. So it's kind of a revenge-driven plot, but also this culture clash comedy going on. And there's some superhero stuff as well, because the minions are, so selected minions are transformed into mega minions with powers that are kind of very obviously based on some familiar superheroes like Mr. Fantastic and The Thing. They're kind of like sort of Fantastic Four, but like talking gibberish. So there's a subplot there. And then eventually all these, and there's a heist element too, I should mention that. All these elements kind of clash together finally. But in not a very sort of good way, really. It's all kind of a bit, it feels very kind of disconnected from each other, these subplots. I don't think it all meshes particularly well in this one, which was sort of similar to the last Minions film a couple of years ago that had these kind of random subplots, which felt like they could be almost sort of competing with each other. But I mean, I found that film much sort of funnier and kind of quicker on its toes than this one. I was very disappointed in this one, I have to say.
Yes, you are someone who has enjoyed the humor of the Minions in the past, oh, yeah, aren't you? So is it just not really deliver on the physical comedy side of the Minions even, really, is it?
No, I mean, they are quite limited characters, yeah, really. And I've like said, it's the sixth movie now. So I feel like they've kind of outstayed their welcome a bit, and they're not really finding anything new for them to do. And always, I think the trouble with Gru is that his arc is completed so well in the first movie, the way he goes from being this villain to then becoming the father to these children and the kind of reforming, mending his ways. That was handled so nicely in the first one. There's never really that much for him to do. And the double disappointment is that you've got Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig in this movie, like two of my absolute favourite funny people. And neither of them are particularly funny. Neither of them get much to do. I mean, well, Ferrell has quite a limited role. He's not in it a great deal. And his character is quite a bog standard villain. So, yeah, I was pretty disappointed with this, I have to say.
I've seen all of the Despicable Me series leading up to this, but I really like the first one, like you.
Yeah, I did.
Not loved any since then. I particularly disliked the second film. I think that was the low point so far.
Yeah,
for me. But then I didn't mind. I thought The Rise of Gru was perhaps the best of the rest of the bunch, and that was obviously the most recent one.
Yeah,
I agree with that. It's a shame that this hasn't kind of carried on with that. By the sounds of it, being half decent, but it's clearly, I mean, it's had quite a staggered release around the world, hasn't it? So it's already out in certain territories and has already made a decent chunk of money. So I'm sure there will be plenty of families going to see it, and I'll probably end up seeing it in that regard as well. But yes, doesn't sound the most inspiring film, sadly.
No, especially coming so soon after another sequel, Inside Out 2, which just feels a lot fresher and funnier, really.
And Inside Out 2 is on course to be like the biggest film of the year at the moment, isn't it, really? It's crossed 1.2 billion as we speak, and it's become Pixar's biggest ever film at the box office. I think it's overtaken Incredibles 2 to be Pixar's biggest film. So it's just seeming unstoppable at the moment.
It really is,
But if you did fancy giving Despicable Me 4 a go, that is in cinemas from Friday the 12th of July. And next up is another of this week's many horror films. So this is In a Violent Nature. Matthew, I've seen this one and you haven't. It's a hard film to describe in a lot of ways, and there's not really much in the way of plot that I can say. And I went to it fairly cold, but with the vaguest idea of what it was about. So I'll try and keep it fairly vague. But basically, in a sense, it's a slasher movie, broadly speaking, and features, you know, familiar slasher elements such as, you know, the woods, kids kind of camping, a killer with various sharp weapons, an often masked killer. And basically, it takes a completely different approach to what you might expect from a slasher movie, in that we largely follow the killer character known as Johnny. And it plays out like, you know, like slow cinema. That's what kind of came to mind when I saw it. And have you ever seen it on TV or anything like that, where they sometimes do those slow things where you just be following like a reindeer walking through the snow for ages? It almost has that vibe to quite a lot of it, in that for a long time you're just following this killer, and just from behind, seeing this character from behind, and you can see he's kind of scarred and messed up, and he originally emerges from under the ground, so he's all kind of dirty and everything. And it's just that kind of like dum, 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 as he's taking these slow footsteps through the woods. And it looks nice, and it creates just a weird atmosphere that was interesting. And again, when you're like us and you just watch a lot of movies like week in, week out, it is interesting to see something just take a completely different approach to a genre, or mix two different types of films you've seen before put together. And I saw a quote in a review that basically called it like Bellatar's take on Friday the 13th to give you a bit of a vibe of what it's like. I thought that summed up quite nicely. So I think some people, certain horror heads and certain genre aficionados, will really appreciate it because it does just do something very different to what you've seen before. But I have to say, I actually just found it largely a bit boring, because you just don't get invested in a story in the way that I like to in a film. And you pick up bits as you go along, because, you know, these various people he comes into contact with, you sort of overhear them a lot of the time. You're kind of overhearing things they're talking about. You spend a brief bit of time with them, and you learn a bit about the backstory of the film's killer for that reason. I just found it very difficult to actually invest in it. So I you know, there were things I could appreciate about it as like an exercise in style, but I just didn't really care about it at all, to be honest. I was a bit underwhelmed by the ending as well. I've seen, again, because it was a sort of film that you are intrigued to go and read a bit about once you've watched it. Yeah. And I've seen some people that love the ending. So again, obviously your mileage may vary, as they say, but I just didn't find it that satisfying. And it's strange because it is, I mean, we spoke about this briefly on Long Legs earlier, but it is very violent in places. It's not one of those films of non-stop violence, if you know what I mean. No. But there's some really over the top kind of gruesome kills. Yeah. So it sort of delivers that, but then sometimes it almost like leans on the comical, because they're just so over the top. It's quite sadistic in terms of there's times where people, you know, there's heads smashed in, and when they're just smashed and smashed and smashed kind of thing. So it goes very full on in that sense. It didn't really feel like a video game because of the slow pace, because of the way you're, for such large parts, you're following just over this person's shoulder, and he selects different weapons at different points. It almost felt like a video game where you were, like an indie video game where you were playing the sort of camp serial killer and going around and dispatching people. But yeah, it was a weird mixed bag for me. But ultimately, I wasn't really that satisfied by it, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to see it. I'm intrigued. I like anything that's kind of got quite a novel conceit to it. And I like the idea of the Bellatar doing Friday the 13th. that kind of appeals to me. I've heard that there's one particularly memorable kill, something to do with a pretzel.
Yes, yeah. I won't go into too much detail for anyone to see it, but
is that particularly nasty?
Yeah, but that is another one that verges on the comical. That probably is the one that most of all verges on the comical, because it's just so over the top. Some of the acting is really bad as well. From the supporting characters, you know, just like when it just gives it a slightly cheap feeling for me, where it just felt like cheaply put together and just slightly lame performances from a lot of the supporting cast, and that slightly unbelievable sort of dialogue. But even though there's not loads of it, but yeah, a strange film where I'll sort of think on it for a long time, even if I didn't like it. And also, weirdly, following the film that we just watched, the Killer's Mask was vaguely reminiscent of a Minion, I thought, as well, because it's this, it's kind of like like sometimes he's not wearing the mask, but then he puts it on at a certain point, and it's sort of like a brown leather hood, but the kind of shape of it, the way it kind of goes over his head, and then it's got these two big goggles like for the eyes. It just felt like some weird, like someone had run through like an AI system, like turn a minion into a serial killer. That's how I felt.
I won't be able to shake that image now when I watch. Is he obsessed with bananas as well?
No, although he doesn't speak, so he does that in common as well.
All right, so you're selling this to me, I have to say.
But if
Charles Friday the 13th with him starring a minion. I'm into this.
This very much earns its 18 certificate, though, this one.
Yeah.
But if you do fancy checking that out, that is In a Violent Nature, which is in cinemas from Friday the 12th of July. And then for the next horror film of the week, but Matthew, don't doze off during this one.
Try not to.
REM 수면 행동 장애를 앓고 있다라는 뜻이에요.
고칠 수 있는 거죠? 오빠!
So that is Sleep, which is a South Korean film, broadly speaking a horror. And it's written and directed by Jason Yu, and this is his debut. It stars Lee Sung-kyun, who is known for his role in Parasite, and he sadly died in real life as well. So it's, you know, one of his last performances. And it's quite a simple conceit, really, isn't it, Matthew? Where basically you've got this couple, and he starts sleepwalking, basically, and committing strange behaviour at night. She's pregnant and soon to give birth, and so she basically starts being concerned, and his behavior gets ever stranger and more concerning, doesn't it, as the thing progresses. But yeah, so I saw this quite a long time ago, but I actually really enjoyed this when I saw it at TIFF. What did you make of it, Matthew, when you caught it more recently?
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. I thought it was very effective. I thought it worked really well as a kind of a domestic drama. I felt very kind of invested in these characters and the tensions between them, the difficulties they're having. I mean, it kind of takes, you know, thrillery directions, but it's such a kind of relatable topic, you know, having troubles with sleep, especially for a couple. I mean, we can both relate to this, being having a young child and then having troubles with sleep as well. I mean, you can really buy into that. But I really like the way it escalates very kind of subtly and incrementally. And it's one of those sort of classic cases of, is this all in a character's head, or is this happening for real? Is there something maybe supernatural happening here? Is there a scientific explanation? So I really enjoyed the play with the tensions between all those factors, and having the baby involved as well. I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing, but that kind of heightens the tension, the vulnerability of having a child there. But just kind of like very, it's sort of small but very disturbing moments, like when the husband starts scratching himself in his sleep, and that kind of goes quite far, and the aftermath of that, and other various things he does, putting him, endangering himself and others, it's all handled really well, I thought. It's in, on Wikipedia, it describes it as a black comedy, but I found it too stressful to be to be a comedy, I have to say.
From my memory, I do remember there being funny elements, but
yeah,
overall, I would remember, I would call it a horror, I suppose, overall, yeah, from that. There's something, yeah, sort of, I wouldn't say funny, but they obviously, as things escalate, they go through ever more measures to try to get him to sort of basically keep him in bed, basically, don't they?
Yeah.
And which is sort of have kind of funny but disturbing elements as well. But yeah, I just found it like a very satisfying, tight little horror film, really.
Yeah, and I did.
It's obviously mostly set in this one location as well. Mm. So yeah, it's just a nice, tight little horror, really.
Yeah. I thought not to spoil anything, but there's some set design towards the end. And I just think, like, kudos to whoever had to go to all those lengths to put this set together at the end. I mean, they must have been, you know, really, really going the extra mile to bring off this this visual, which I thought was very effective.
Mm. So if you fancy checking that out as well, I mean, in a week full of horror releases, that is Sleep, and that is in cinemas as well from Friday the 12th of July. We're almost at the end of the podcast now. There's a couple other films just to briefly mention. There's Hundreds of Beavers, which neither of us have seen, but Jamie Graham, frequently heard on this podcast, rates it very highly. And it does sound incredibly intriguing. It's this sort of black and white comedy, like sort of really broad, physical, old-fashioned comedy in the sort of, you know, Buster Keaton mold. It kind of seemed to come out a while ago, didn't it? It premiered at a festival quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it's not getting its release until now. It sounds really just completely bonkers, and it's got these people in these very fake-looking big beaver costumes.
And they knew what they were doing with that title.
Exactly. Like, the title is the gift.
They knew what they were doing.
The title is the gift that keeps on giving in really Total is. Film meetings. But so I haven't seen it yet, but I will be trying to check that out because it just sounds bonkers. But
me too.
Yes, that comes very, very highly recommended from Jamie Graham. And then I also wanted to give another just brief shout out to a film that's releasing next week, and we're actually going to have a break from the podcast next week, and we'll be back the week after. But next week, on the 19th of July, there's a film called Thelma coming out, which is a, broadly speaking, it's like a sort of a geriatric actioner, I suppose you might call it, where June Squibb plays this 93-year-old woman who basically ends up getting involved in a scam and then goes about trying to, you know, rectify the situation with the help of her grandson, who's played by Fred Heschinger, who you might know from The White Lotus. She also teams up with the late Richard Roundtree, who has like a really sort of lovely final role here. And it's an interesting film in a way, because it's very, very light, very throwaway almost. And I would give it, like, if I was reviewing it, I'd give it 3 stars, really. It's like just an entertaining, enjoyable little film. But it's interesting because it's just not like necessarily like the out and out. It's not like a satirical comedy of like, let's just throw like an older person into an action film scenario. No. They kind of do it in a nice way, but it feels just about kind of believable. And there's some elements like where they're kind of chasing on a mobility scooter and things like that, but it doesn't feel like they play it for laughs in that obvious like Mickey taking way. It just feels like they apply those tropes to this scenario of this woman. And June Squibb's obviously always very enjoyable, and she maybe this will be like an awards contender for her. I wouldn't be surprised. I think obviously the film, it's in general, I can't see being a big awards contender, but I really wouldn't be surprised to see her nominated for this. I saw this via the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and it was just really, really enjoyable, cute little film, basically, with an enjoyable cameo from Malcolm McDowell as well in the mix. So if you like the sound of that, that's out next week on 19th of July. But that's nearly all from us for now. Matthew, what would you say your film of the week is this week out of everything you've seen?
Well, that's tricky. It's going to have to be a tie for me, I think, between Fly Me to the Moon and Sleep. Perhaps Sleep just edging it just about, but yeah, those two.
This is, yeah, it's really, really tricky for me because, yeah, overall, in terms of best film this week, I would say Sleep. In terms of the must-see, I would add Twisters into the mix probably, because I feel like if you're going to see one at the cinema, that yeah. feels like the cinema experience for me. But the most satisfying film overall is Sleep. And obviously, a couple of those I haven't seen, so I haven't seen Long Legs yet, so I can't have that in as my contenders, but I will be checking it out. We're very nearly at the end of the episode now. Our Deadpool and Wolverine issue is still on sale, and if you keep your eyes peeled on Friday afternoon, you'll get a glimpse of our new covers for the next issue on social media. So keep your eyes peeled on Friday afternoon for that. And if you do fancy subscribing to the magazine, there is a subscription link in the podcast notes, so check that out. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. We always like to hear from you. But before we go, just time for a very quick question. Which director would you like to see take on a slasher film? If we're thinking of In a Violent Nature as Bellatar's Friday the 13th, which blend would you like to see?
I'd go for Greta Gerwig. I think all her films so far have all been quite different. So I think I'd like to see her, you know, and she's had a success with different genres. You know, she's done the period drama, the indie comedy, obviously the big colourful blockbuster. Yeah, I'd like to see what she'd do with the slasher and see how she'd adapt her style to that. So she feels like just, you know, one of the most flexible directors around at the moment. So that'd be my vote.
I would probably choose this. I'm going to say Charlie Kaufman, just because
Charlie Kaufman.
I enjoy his films. I feel like he could do with a commercial hit, you know, because his films often aren't that successful. So he could probably do with a good commercial hit in the bank. And obviously horror always does well at the cinema. And yeah. I just would love to see his kind of really cerebral kind of brain twisty take on what a slasher could be. And I actually find some of his films quite scary, particularly I'm thinking of Ending Things. I actually thought that was really sort of bordered on the quite scary in a lot of places. So I feel like he'd be well suited just to make something in very that's, you know, definitively in the horror space. So,
yeah, he'd find some kind of unusual angle, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Refresh the genre somehow or tear it apart.
So that's what I'm going for. So that's all from us this week. And remember, there'll be no episode next week, but we'll be back the week after that. So thanks very much for listening. And until then, goodbye.
Goodbye. Deep in the bosom of the gentle night is when I saw trigger light. Pick up my pen and start to write. I struggle to fight dark forces in the clear moonlight without fear. Insomnia. I can't get no sleep.